What is Peace Brain? Peace Brain is the synergistic connection between our mental and emotional bodies, blending the electrical power of the mind with the magnetic force of the heart. Listen and explore how to create unity worldwide as we blend science and metaphysics and open our hearts and minds to the possibilities of peace on Earth and create the life we are each destined for. Featured guests range from angel communicators to zoologists and everything in between. Now here is your host, Dr. Gail Lash.
Hello and welcome to the Peace Brain Show. This is your host, Dr. Gail Lash, and I'm so happy to have you here today. Today on the Peace Brain Show, I'm really excited. We'll be discussing the powerful topics of unconscious bias, privilege, diversity, equity and inclusion benchmarks, and how to create a culture of diversity and inclusion. And of course, that's so important today in today's world. I am working with the zoos. I don't know if you guys have checked out my website, tourismforpeace.com, but we also work with zoos and design zoos. And this show particularly will be about diversity and inclusion because the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or AZA.org, you can go to there and find out more about it, is a collection of institutions that has accredited zoos and aquariums all over the United States and North America. And so it's important to know that that diversity obviously is very important for zoos and aquariums, and that, as with the rest of the world today. So we're going to be talking about that and just a human behavior. So you're going to learn a lot about human behavior and the way that we perceive things today with my guest when I bring him on the show. And of course, at the end of the show, we're going to have a transformative meditation, so please stay tuned for that. But first, as always, I want to open the show with a quote. And this is a quote I picked from Tupac Shakur, and I really like what he said here. He said, "I'm not saying I'm going to change the world, but I guarantee that I will spark the brain that will change the world." And I really like this because certainly Tupac did this with his music, his life and his death. But also, here on the Peace Brain Show, it's our intention to spark your brain, to spark your peace brain with new ideas that connect your head and your heart, that provide ways in which we really can make this a world of peace, that it actually happens. So I'm happy to say that our radio guest today does that. He gets us to think differently, and as he says, in order to be the good. So I want to introduce my guest. It's Eric Bailey, and he's from Bailey Strategic Innovation Group in Phoenix, Arizona. He is the co-founder and president of Bailey Strategic Innovation Group. He has a uniquely diverse set of experiences, including helping future NFL Hall of Famer Larry Fitzgerald pet a rhinoceros, teaching dozens of young children to ski, changing the strategic course of cities across the country, jumping out of an airplane with his wife, flying an F-16, and chatting with LL Cool J on the campus of Harvard University. Eric understands that no matter what life puts in your path, there are lessons to be learned or stories to be told. And you can find out more about Eric at Bailey Innovation Group, that's B-A-I-L-E-Y, Innovation, I-N-N-O-V-A-T-I-O-N, Group, G-R-O-U-P, .com. Welcome, Eric, to the Peace Brain Show.
Thank you so much, Gail, for having me.
It's a delight to have you here, and I know one of the reasons, well, one of the main reasons you're on the show today is because you are going to be a keynote speaker at the AZA Mid-Year Conference, which is coming up in April, and there's a diversity summit, a one-day summit, and you're the keynote speaker for that. So thank you so much for doing that. That's such a delight to have you be at that convention.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. And one thing that I love doing is giving people a new perspective on seeing things. And so the topic of the keynote is going to be a new conversation on bias. Because we oftentimes have a way of seeing things or a way of understanding the way the world works as accurately or inaccurate as it may be. But if we can approach this conversation in a new, different way, then we can have new and different outcomes, which is the goal.
Fantastic. Now, that's fantastic. So I want to start off, though, and first of all, I do encourage people to go to your website because it's an amazing website, and you've got some fun little brain tricks on your website.
I do.
Yeah, I was looking at those and going, wow, this is really cool. Just puzzles that make your brain think a different way. And again, that's BaileyInnovationGroup.com. So thank you for making it be a fun website, not just one full of great information. But also, you know, speaking about zoos, we are talking about that you had actually some connection with zoos in your younger days. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so I actually have a strong affinity for zoos and aquariums, and me and my family now with three kids, we're members of the Odyssey in the Desert Aquarium here in Phoenix, because we just love spending time with animals. But back when I was in college, I needed a job for the busy spring break time in Phoenix, and a friend of mine said, hey, why don't you go apply to this position at the Phoenix Zoo? And so I walk in, and I didn't realize it at the time, but the position I was applying for wasn't for the zoo as a company. It was actually for one of the vendors at the zoo, the Kettle Corn Company. And so I walked in, and I got interviewed, and I just thought it was just a really fun way to waste a few months of time to get paid for it. And
right.
So I was popping kettle corn. I still have some scarring on my forearms from the caramelized sugar sticking to my arm. But over that month, the gentleman who owned the company, Scott Grondin, he pulled me aside and said, you know, your interaction with the other employees and your interaction with the customers is on a different level. I would like to ask you to be a manager. And so I was like, oh, that'd be fantastic. So over the course of a summer, he kind of trained me how to be a manager. And then I said, you know, I would like to train other people. I'd like to train customer service. So I developed my own customer service training program, for that company. And our employees started being really, really good. And we actually caught the attention of, the director of guest services for the Phoenix Zoo. And, she came up to me and said, and her name is Jennifer. She said, hey, Eric, would you, let me sit in on some of your trainings. And she sat in, and we started this really wonderful dialogue, and eventually we developed a new way to do guest services at the zoo. And after a couple of years, she said, Eric, would you run this department for me? So
wow.
I left the Kettle Corn Company and became the guest services manager for the zoo. So I was actually a zoo employee, and I got to wear the khaki cargo shorts and everything. So I love animals, but I never studied animals. And so, when I would interact with keepers, I'd say, well, you guys, you may be a hoofstock keeper, but I'm a keeper of the Homo sapiens. So I'm also an animal keeper too, just a different kind of animal.
That's
true. So I worked for the Phoenix Zoo. It is, right? And so I worked for the Phoenix Zoo for about 5 years. I transitioned after about 3 years or so in guest services. I transitioned to the marketing team, and I actually ran the zoo's Twitter account. This is several years ago when Twitter was relatively new, and we entered into a contest with the National Zoo and Steve Irwin Zoo, the Australia Zoo. And San Diego Zoo and a number of other zoos to be the first zoo in the world with 10,000 Twitter followers,
and we won.
So that's a claim to fame for us. So that was a lot of fun. So, and you mentioned, that I did get to help Larry Fitzgerald pet a rhinoceros, which is a true story. When I was on the marketing team, he and his son came in, and I drove him around and gave him a private tour. And we coordinated with, the rhino keepers, and we got to go back in the night house, and he got to pet the rhino. He and his son got to pet the rhino. So that was kind of fun. So, I've got a strong affinity for zoos and spent a good bulk of my formative years in my career, there at the Phoenix Zoo.
Wow, you sure did. Thank you for sharing that history. That is amazing. And I want to point out to our listeners, you know, most of the times we think about zoos, obviously, as being about the animals, the non-human animals.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
Truly, a zoo is like a city. A zoo or an aquarium is like a city. It has all these departments that any other mm-hmm. major corporation would have or city would have. So if there's anyone out there thinking about jobs, whether you're in marketing or, as you said, guest services, food services, everything a zoo has. Obviously,
HR and everything, yeah.
HR,
yeah.
Exactly. Security and just, you really, the sky is the limit of what can be done at a zoo. So I encourage you to apply, to check into your mm-hmm. local zoo or aquarium to find out more about what services they have that they're looking always for good human personnel. and managing the visitors is so key. You know, the zoos are all about education, so obviously education departments are key. But it's really about how do we teach humans about the natural world. So
exactly.
That includes everything.
mm-hmm.
So speaking of human behavior and understanding, you have, as you said, a different way of looking at the world and the way human behavior, how we as humans behave. Tell me a little bit of what got you, obviously your guest services training, working with the visitor at the zoos, developed this, but why do you think differently?
So I've always found that people are fascinating. When I see someone act or react in a way that I didn't expect, I find that absolutely fascinating. I learned from my experience of life, for the most part, being misunderstood or not being understood. I always try to figure out what is it? What is happening? Why don't people understand me or what I'm saying or what I'm thinking? And so I've actually had this deep passion to be understood and to understand other humans. And over the course of my career and over the course of my education, I actually started getting into some research articles on human behavior and human psychology and neuroscience. And as I started to kind of digest that information, I started to reshare it, and people started to react really powerfully because I was able to translate this high level, you know, psychology research, into normal human speak. And people were able to understand themselves better, understand each other better. I was able to understand people better. And so I started to develop a methodology based in all of this research. And I called it the principles of human understanding. And basically they're all, foundational principles that all humans deal with, usually mostly in communication, and collaboration. But as I started to go through this, I realized that there are certain things that all of us run into, just based in normal psychology and normal brain physiology that prevent us from having deeper conversations or prevent us from having meaningful conversations. You know, we get stuck in debate. We get stuck in fighting to be right and all these sorts of things. And when you understand these principles of human understanding, the first part is you can understand other people better. And the second part is you can understand yourself better and catch yourself before you step into a hole, you know. And it's powerful to share these principles with the world. And so that's really what I'm up to right now is I'm going around to organizations and, as you mentioned earlier, cities. I go to a lot of cities and I work with a lot of city councils and I work with a lot of companies and help people understand how to communicate more effectively.
Wow. And that's so important to take that research in psychology and neuroscience and bring it into a language, as you just said, that everyone can understand, and that we can mm-hmm. put into these principles to actually begin to practice. I notice you've got the principles, the 10 listed on your website. It mm-hmm. it is such a time in our society, and I think that obviously I'm wanting world peace, and I'm wanting mm-hmm. this world begin to understand each other. That is so important mm-hmm. that we begin to have these meaningful conversations, as you just said. So
absolutely.
Pick one or two or several to talk about. Where do you want to go with this?
Yeah, that's great. So the first one listed there, it's the most important because it's foundational. So it's called the illusion of certainty. And so if it's okay with you, I'd like to run through an exercise that you and your listeners can go through to kind of understand this principle. So if you think about a bicycle, think about a bicycle, like everyone knows what a bicycle looks like, right? So if you have a pen and paper handy, what I would like you to do, I would like you to just draw a bicycle. And, you know, I would, you know, typically when I'm working with a group, I would allow people, you know, time to sit and draw a bicycle, but I understand there's a pause button, so your listeners can pause and they can, you know, do their bicycle. What typically happens in this exercise is as people start to draw the bicycle, there's this wave that happens over them when they realize, oh my gosh, I don't know how to draw a bicycle. They'll start with the wheels, they'll make a frame, a rudimentary frame, or maybe some handlebars, and then once again, this thing washes over them that they can't do it accurately. People will forget all the time, they'll forget their pedals, they'll forget the chain on the bicycle, they can't figure out how the seat connects to the frame, connects to the tires, and that wave, that wash of feeling, what that experience is, that's the illusion of certainty fading away. Because
and you're
I know
correct.
What a bicycle looks like. I'm sure of it.
You're correct. I started with the wheels, and mm-hmm. then I drew a line between them, and I drew the handlebars, and then the pedals and the seat, and a little thing on the back wheel to maybe put your bag on, that type of thing.
Uh-huh.
But the details, so mine is a very childlike drawing. The details
right.
of the chain and all of that are not there, because you're right. I'd have to look
right.
at a bicycle. Yes.
Uh-huh.
And
it's funny because about 80% of adults mm-hmm. cannot draw a bicycle. That would actually be a functional bicycle. And if you ask who knows what a bicycle looks like, 100% of adults would say, yes, I'm certain I know what a bicycle looks like. And then when it comes down to it, oh, wait, you don't. And so
wow.
this illusion of certainty, it's our brain, we have this propensity to project certainty. So even if we're uncertain, our brain wants us to say, yes, we're certain. And
that's
so as adults, when people ask us questions, the first thing we want to do is answer the question. Whether we know the answer or not, our brain will actually trick us into believing that our answer is correct. And how that shows up for us is, you know, you mentioned earlier how we have this discourse happening. And when people find themselves on a different side of a debate from somebody else, well, that illusion of certainty will kick in and we will believe that we were right and we will fight tooth and nail to prove that we are right. And there's some other principles that help reinforce all of that. But that illusion of certainty is the first thing that's there. You know,
So you're saying we need to abandon the illusion of certainty?
or just acknowledge that it's always going to be there. And that's one thing is a lot of these things, these principles, they're natural human psychology, and so we can't get rid of them. But if we can acknowledge that they exist, we can intentionally try to reduce their impact on our behaviors.
Exactly. And I want to share a quick story with you that actually has to do with a bicycle, since you brought up a bicycle. And that is that last night, my husband and I went to see a movie called The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. And it's from a book, actually, and I really highly recommend everyone to see it. It's about a young boy in Malawi who creates a well to pump water, so that they can have water during the drought and grow a second crop to prevent famine. Mm. And he does it by using a bicycle and a dynamo.
Oh, wow.
So he takes apart a bicycle and uses it with the gears to actually turn the windmill and help pump the water. So that's when you said bicycle, I'm going, well, in Malawi. So I'm sure we have these associations as well. I don't know if that's one of your principles down the line, but where it makes us think of other things when someone is talking to us as well.
Absolutely. It's very powerful when you start to understand how our brains work. And the reason I usually start with this one, the illusion of certainty, is because what it points out for us is that our brains want to project that we already know. And the thing that I push when I say this is the only things in life that we can learn are things that we don't yet know. And if the illusion of certainty has its way, it will project that we know everything, which means there's nothing left to learn.
Yes, yes. I see the distinction. You're right. That's great.
It's powerful. It's powerful. Mm-hmm. It changes the way you see the world. And especially when, you know, kind of going back to the idea of debating with somebody on politics, you know, if someone has an opposing view from us, our first reaction is, I'm certain you're wrong, I'm right. But what I see is there's opportunity to learn. And so if someone sees something differently than the way we do, it's not that they're an idiot. You know, what it is there's an opportunity to learn something else. And we don't need to validate their opinion. We don't need to say that they're correct, but we can understand why they think that way. And when we do that, we actually have an opportunity to change the way the world works. And I love, you know, the name of your podcast, The Peace Brain, because that's essentially what I'm trying to affect in people. I want to give people peace through work with the brain. And if we can do that with enough people, we change the world. And it's a powerful, powerful thing that we're trying to accomplish.
Exactly. I agree. It is so important we have these meaningful conversations, and they're not going to happen unless we're willing to sit back and listen and question mm-hmm. each other to really learn where the foundations of our understandings come from. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to go over another principle of understanding?
Yes. Yeah. So as we're talking about diversity with the AZA, it's more than just diversity, because diversity is an almost impossible to define topic, but it's about inclusion. It's about understanding bias. And the first thing to understand is that we have this very negative association with the word bias. And it's an erroneous association. So a lot of people say bias is bad because bias equals racism. That's not true. Bias does not equal racism. Bias is actually a psychological principle, and it's defined as a systematic error in thinking that impacts our behaviors and our judgments. And so when you think about that.
Say that one more time.
It's a systematic error in thinking that impacts our behaviors and our judgments.
Got it.
And so bias can lead to racism for sure, but bias is not in and of itself racism. And so if we let go of that binary of good, bad, and say, you know, mm-hmm. trying to assign bias is bad. Because when we assign that bias is bad, then everyone wants to say, I don't have bias. If bias is bad, and bias is racist, well, I'm not racist.
So,
exactly. Exactly. And the powerful notion is that bias is actually something that we've developed to survive as a species. And so, example here is, you know, you're wandering through the forests of northwestern Oregon, and you've lost your campsite, you've lost your entire party, you lost for 3 days, and you're hungry and you're thirsty and you're scared because there's bears and you don't know what to do. And you look across this fallen tree, and growing on top of that tree is a bunch of ivy, and then you see a bunch of red berries. Do you eat those berries? Most people would say, absolutely not. Like, I don't know those berries. I don't trust those berries, because if you don't know red berries, your first thought is they may be poisonous, right? Now, the reason we don't trust those red berries is because of bias. Because, you know, back when we were, you know, cavemen and cavewomen were, you know, strolling through the forest, and we saw someone eat a handful of red berries and die. And so red is one of nature's symbols, and bright colors, one of nature's symbols of poison. And so we have this bias against red berries. We don't prefer to eat red berries because they could kill us. And so that bias has actually kept us alive. That bias saved our lives. And so bias isn't bad. It just is. And it's something we've developed to survive as a species. And so, when I start to talk about bias, there's a whole battery of psychological biases that we can talk about, but there's a number of them that are very impactful in our life. And one of them is called the availability heuristic. And it's a really fun one. It's very powerful. basically says that, you know, we're able to recall things that are closer to things that we've recalled recently in the past. It's more available to us. So let me walk you through an exercise.
Okay.
I'm going to describe a person, and, you know, go ahead, you can close your eyes if you want to, and I want you to just picture this person, and as I describe them, I just want you to, you know, kind of revise your image of this person, you know, kind of piece by piece by piece. All right?
Okay.
So,
I'm ready.
This person is a librarian. All right? This person has blonde hair. This person wears glasses. This person is about 5'6" tall. This person typically wears a red sweater to work. This person spends a lot of time on the computer, obviously as a librarian. This person's name is Stefan. Now, did your image of this person change when I got to the last fact about him?
You know, so this is the thought process that I had. Librarian, obviously, mm-hmm. I began to think of female because my mm-hmm. bias is that females are in librarians, are librarians.
Yes.
However, mm-hmm. I recognized that as a bias immediately. And I changed the librarian to a male. So as you went through, I began to imagine actually a male with long hair and glasses and 5'6". And actually, again, this is, you know, speaking as a white person, I have a bias. But also mm-hmm. I said, oh, well, let me make him a person of color. And so when you mm-hmm. got to the end, actually I had a young man in his 20s with a long hair, with glasses, who was, you know, African American looking, and mm-hmm. so when you said Stefan, I went, yeah, okay, because I you're absolutely correct. I recognized the first moment of, oh, I'm going to female immediately for librarian. Let me switch the gender. So
that's wonderful.
So thank you though,
and so,
because
and so
that
most,
is yes.
Yeah, most people go there, and as soon as I said librarian, if any of your listeners went through the process with me or with us, they looked at all the different elements, and once they said librarian, it's very easy to assign, okay, blonde hair, glasses, red sweater, 5'6", yep, that just reinforces female librarian.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there are male librarians, and as we go through, that availability heuristic actually plays a part in how we expect to see the world. And so we expected, you know, librarian female, we built everything up as a female, except for someone who decides to intentionally change it, which is part of the lesson, is people will go through. And when they get to that final fact, Stefan, that's not a female name. You must mean Stephanie. You said it wrong. Right? So sometimes that illusion of certainty will kick in and try to reinforce
yeah.
everything. But when you think about the power of that availability heuristic, oftentimes it can lead you down the path of judgment. So it's bad that I thought a female. It's bad that I thought this. It's not. It's not bad. It just is. And mm-hmm. as you just experienced, and you just explained, if you are intentional and you understand that these things exist, then you can make intentional decisions to act in a different way. And it's powerful. You know, the first thing you want to do is you want to judge other people. And unfortunately, we do that far too often. It's very fun to judge other people. Because mm-hmm. why we like the people watching the malls, right? It's because it's fun. But if we can be aware of it, then we can choose to make different decisions. And so, you know, just as understanding the availability heuristic, if the most frequent thing that we have available is that bosses are male and white, then we are going to, if we happen to be in a position to hire someone who's going to be a boss, understand that availability heuristic is somewhere in there, and let's look at different characteristics, or let's blind our interviews, or let's do something different to change our decision-making process through those biases.
And you're right. That's so important for managers and for changing the workforce to be more inclusive and and reflect our society today. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I've taken one of those tests online. I'm not sure where it was. Mm-hmm. I think we may have done it at one of our diversity summits. Exactly, where I'm a biologist, I'm a scientist. So whenever someone says scientist, most people will think of male, and I realize that we have to start thinking of women in science and women in different organizations and different placeholders and these organizations that typically are biased towards the male. So those are that's a great exercise. Thank you.
Yeah.
Does your company, you're working with employee understanding and with managers to understand the human brain more. Have you, you mentioned earlier about wanting to create peace and the name Peace Brain on the show. Have you ever done anything specifically or used the word peace in your presentation? I'm
so
going a little new here.
No, it's interesting because one thing that I've found is that the more universal I can make my message, the more impact it will have. And so one thing that I do is I say, here are the things that I do. And so, in my consulting firm, we do strategic planning, we do leadership development, we do communication training, we do team development, all those things. But that's just what I say that I do. And that's just the functional aspect of it. But then two layers deeper is what I'm actually up to. And what I'm actually up to is I'm trying to change the way the world communicates. And I know that happens when people feel peace. And I pay attention to the energy in the room as I do my exercises, to see if I'm achieving that goal of peace. Because I know that when people are conflicted, there's a level of stress, there's a level of tension. Going back to the physiology of the brain, there's a chemical called cortisol that's released in the brain when we're under stress. And there's a number of exercises that I do that are intentionally designed to reduce cortisol. So, in fact, the bicycle exercise that you just did, there's actually really wonderful research out of Drexel University that found that when you put a pencil to paper, a pen to paper, and you move it around, whether you're drawing or writing, that actually reduces the levels of cortisol in your brain. And so there's the lesson that I teach about the illusion of certainty and, what you know and what you don't know. But then again, underneath that, I actually lowered your level of stress by having you go through that exercise. And so again, there's things that I do and then there's really what I'm up to underneath. And what I want to do is I want to give people the experience of being at peace, especially in, conversations that are difficult to have. So, an employee going and asking a boss for a raise, the boss says no. That's an inherently stressful situation. So how can I give that boss tools so they can handle that and pay attention to the employee's stress levels and reduce that? Or how can I give that employee confidence to go into that conversation knowing that the answer may be no and still come away feeling empowered to do their job well? And so I don't ever explicitly say the word peace, or that's what I'm up to, but that is what I'm up to.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for explaining that. It really did sound like that, and it is so important to realize that you just gave that example of an employee going in and asking for a raise and it possibly being no, that it's really important to realize that just because someone, I'll use the word rejects us, says no, we don't have to take it that it's personal. How can I explain this? Obviously, it is. There's something that employee's not meeting a criteria. So in that regard, it is personal. But it's not who we are. We are not our job. We are not our job description. We are not actually our story in one essence. So for me, in my teachings and workings with, I look at our spirit, our who are you? Who did you come here to be? And what are your unique gifts and talents, and those can be applied in multiple ways of service to humanity. So it's about having, as you said, that confidence within oneself to be able to walk through this world and receive rejections, receive no's, and realize, well, okay, I'm not the perfect fit for that particular job, but that doesn't mean I'm any less of a person.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Important.
I I run a YouTube series called The Walking Meeting, and
I love it. It's
fun. It's a lot of fun. And so it's a 2-minute leadership lesson. And one of them is, actually the first one that I did was about feedback and why employees take feedback so poorly and why bosses deliver feedback so poorly. And there's a lot of research on why this happens. But when it comes down to it, if someone receiving feedback takes the feedback not as what I've done, but takes the feedback as who I am, so as a judgment on who I am, then it will actually spark our natural defense mechanism. And yeah. That feedback will trigger a lot of emotional reactions. They can't be right, this. And so the lesson, there's kind of two lessons. The first lesson is, as someone receiving feedback, understand that the feedback is not about who you are, as you just mentioned. It's actually about the work that has happened or the how you did the work, but not who you are. And then that becomes actionable. The second lesson is, as someone delivering feedback, be very intentional about the words that you choose, because you do not want that person to hear that feedback as a judgment of who they are. You want it to be about the work that they've done. And that happens a lot in context, the way that you say that, the tone that you use, etc., because you need to monitor that person's cortisol, monitor their stress reactions, monitor their defensive reactions. And if you notice that someone you're saying something and they're getting into a situation where maybe their face turns red, or you notice their hands shaking, or you notice them swallowing a lot more because they've lost moisture in their mouth, all those are signs of that defense mechanism. And if you get someone there, stop the conversation. Because mm-hmm. you're now going to be going up against someone who's playing defense, and the learning isn't going to happen. The communication isn't going to happen at the level you want. And so just pause and take a breath and say, it seems as if I've sparked an emotional reaction here. That was not my intention. I want you to know that was not my intention. Let's go ahead and take a step back. And if you want, can you tell me what you're feeling right now? And then change the conversation about, you know, making them feel comfortable again in the conversation. And once they do, once they calm down, once their faces turn back to normal color, you know, all these things, then you can attempt to go back into it. And then just, if it happens again, pause again. And what you notice is, in these conversations, all of a sudden, you are having more impactful, meaningful conversations, and you will leave the conversation stronger as a relationship than you were going into it. Typical in these situations is that person gets defensive and they say, like, you're wrong, which makes you get defensive, and then you start attacking back, and the relationship leaves more strained than when it started. And then the feedback isn't ever going to be considered.
Thank you. That's a great prescription for a boss talking to an employee or mm-hmm. some kind of managerial levels, hierarchy levels that we have in our society. I want to just re-mention your walking meeting, because that is on your website. You do have some mm-hmm. clips from those YouTubes, and they're very wonderful 2-minute, 3-minute leadership exercises, as you said. You mentioned one thing, though, that fascinates me, and that is that drawing, picking up the pen and drawing on paper, like we did with the bicycle, mm-hmm. lowers the cortisol level, mm-hmm. our stress hormones. Mm-hmm. And so, are you encouraging people to use art, to use drawing, to use physical pen and paper at their work versus computer?
I always recommend it. I always carry around 2 notebooks with me, one just in case the first one fills up. So I take all of my notes physically on paper with pen, just because I understand that, and I try to be very intentional about managing my stress levels. And you know, my consulting firm is one of the fastest growing consulting firms on the West Coast of the United States, and so that comes with a set of inherent stressors. And so I do whatever I can to reduce my stress. In fact, my family, my wife, and our kids, one thing that we do a lot is we like to do game night, and we changed that a little bit, and we've incorporated in coloring night. And so we have a bunch of coloring books. There's a huge influx of adult coloring books right now. And just, we have probably, 2,000 color pencils. and we just spend an hour some nights, and we just color. And it's a really wonderful exercise to you know, and as I mentioned, I try to pay attention to the energy in the room. And once everyone gets locked into their work and they start coloring, you notice not only is it quieter, which is wonderful with three kids, but you just notice it's calmer. And that's what I notice is that cortisol is releasing, and we're more calm and more present. And as we start to interact with one another, our voices change, the tone of our voices change. And, so yes, I always encourage as much as possible for people to put pen to paper or pencil to paper and move it around. When I notice in my sessions, if someone is just starts doodling on a page, I don't stop that behavior. I encourage that behavior because, you know, people don't understand why they doodle, but they know that they doodle and it feels good. It's because that cortisol is being reduced. And, and when it happens in meetings, the first reaction for a lot of folks is, oh, they're not paying attention. Well, it's not true. They're doodling so that they can pay attention, you know? And so I love the idea of incorporating drawing, writing, art into our normal daily lives. Especially when we're living in a very digital world where more and more we're, you know, typing or we're voice dictating. But if you have the opportunity to take handwritten notes, do it. You know, people say, well, digital is just so much better. So it's searchable, et cetera. I understand that, but there's many apps. If you want to search your notes, there's apps you can scan your notes in and you can still search them. But a lot of times people take notes from the computer and they never review them anyway. So, you know,
Good point.
A lot of times we just use the tool that's in front of us. But taking handwritten notes, is a very powerful way to manage stress.
Interesting. So it sounds like art is definitely good for the workplace. And that's an unconscious bias. Mm-hmm. When you just said that doodling someone, we feel like they're not paying attention. That's an unconscious bias. Right. That
absolutely.
I know I was taught, although I love art and love to doodle and things like that. So it's important to, do you think, I'm just envisioning a new corporate climate that if we had art as a main or handwritten notes, or we had art as an exercise maybe once a day or once a week or whatever time periods. But also I'm thinking about poetry and thinking about music and thinking about drama or skits and role playing. Do you ever incorporate any of those, or what have you found about the other arts, if you will, in the corporate environment?
Yeah, so every single session that I do, whether it's a 2-day retreat with the city council or with a small team retreat, I always incorporate music. Music is fundamental to the work that I do. Tons of research on music. I'm not going to go into all of it, but I've curated this wonderful playlist that spans genres. But I noticed that even if the music that is playing is not music that people would typically listen to, people are always more upbeat when the music is on. What happens a lot of times is, during a break, say I give everyone a 15-minute break, and I don't have music playing or I forget to turn the music on, people go right to their phones. And they just, you know, start scrolling emails or Facebook or whatever. When I have the music playing, though, people are more likely to start talking to one another. And it's really interesting to watch that happen.
Wow.
But you mentioned, it's powerful. It's very powerful. You mentioned, poetry. I don't actually do any poetry. However, I do skits quite a bit. Role plays and skits, for a couple of different reasons. One, it gets people out of their comfort zone. And they realize that they didn't die by doing something out of their comfort zone. And then, but two, they have a lot of fun with it. And so you know, I do work with, one time a small town out here in Arizona with their public works team. Public works is, you know, the water departments and their street departments and, you know, the garbage collectors. And I asked them to do skits, and they had a blast. And their skits were hilarious. And all of a sudden, there's really wonderful, again, a wonderful energy that's flowing through the room where everyone's just having a great time. Not only that, they're connecting on a different level with one another. And so, you mentioned, imagine a new corporate environment where we are incorporating new things. I don't think that we need to imagine a utopian corporate environment. I think that all we need to do is have a couple of people integrating a couple of these things, and then that will create a culture, and that culture can then spread. And that's really what I want to do is how can we influence people to try something new, kind of step into that which we don't know. That's the only things we can learn. Step into that and try some things. Give people some options, Don't force people to write handwritten notes, but give them the option to, and explain the science behind it. So let's give it a shot for a week and see how that goes. Instead of forcing people to do this kind of art or that kind of art, say, here's some options. We're going to spend some time and we're going to have, 30 minutes of just free time where we're not actually going to do the task list that we have. We're going to hear some options. You can do coloring book pages. You can listen to some music. You can do poetry. You can do, here's some options you have and let's see how we feel afterwards. And giving people options to do those sorts of things. And then this is what I like to do is let's get the feedback. What's the data? How did that affect us? Did we enjoy that? A lot of folks are transitioning to this no email on Thursday or any given day. So they say, okay, no email communication on this day. And what that means is that if you want to talk to somebody, you need to either call them or get off your seat and go talk to them. And what they find is what that adds to is it adds to more human connections because you're talking to someone voice to voice, but also it adds more opportunities for collisions. And collisions are just when you happen to bump into somebody in the hallway and that sparks a conversation. Again, that changes the culture of an organization when you have people actually connecting with other human beings.
Bravo, well said. I can see it. Yes. Well, we're getting toward the end of the show. We still have a few minutes that you can share your words of wisdom. What do you want to kind of leave our listeners with?
One thing that I think is really important is there's this thing that happens all the time, and I mentioned at the top of the show about debate. And we love to debate people, and especially now in the current political climate, it's very easy to see who's on what team. And when one team offers a suggestion, the other team automatically doesn't like it. And that gets into a little bit of tribalism. We're not going to go into it, and maybe we'll have an opportunity to chat in the future. We can talk about it. But we talk about debate. I actually like to point out that there's two levels in any argument. There's why do you care about it, and then kind of method. So it's purpose and process. And so purpose is the why, the result, the ultimate outcomes. And the process is the how or the method by which to get there. And when we debate, we end up debating in the how. We debate the process, not the purpose. And we stay mired in the how instead of paying attention to the why. And so one example that I like to talk about all the time, just because it's top of our minds right now, is the border wall. So, almost everywhere on Facebook, you're going to see these debates about the border wall, and people say, don't talk about the border wall, it's too political. But it's not. And it's a wonderful example of how we debate in the how, not the why. So, if you think about this, on one side of the debate, we have people say, we need to build a wall. The other side of the debate, we have people who say, we don't need to build a wall. And so we're actually debating wall. And the wall is a method, not an outcome, not a purpose. And so, let's look at one side. People say we need to build a wall. Why do they say that? And if you dig down and you ask someone, they say, well, I think it's important that we have national security. Well, does everyone think it's important that we have national security? Of course. Well, the other side, well, why were they saying no wall? Well, this other side says, well, we need to monitor fiscal responsibility. And doing this wall doesn't seem like it's very fiscally responsible. And so can we all agree that fiscal responsibility is important? Yeah. And so when you realize that we all agree that fiscal responsibility is important, and we all agree that national security is important, well, we're actually not on separate teams. We're actually on the same team. Once we let go of the method or the how and go to the why level, we can always find common desired result, that common alignment of purpose. And when we do that, what happens next is we then have the opportunity to come up with a creative solution that gives us national security and gives us fiscal responsibility. And that's something that we're not willing to do at this point because we're staying at the level of how, not going deep enough into the why. And if you think about any debate can be solved when you let go of your idea being the one true right idea and try to identify a common desired result. And so when we talk about biases, when we talk about diversity and inclusion, you know, there's all kinds of debates that happen. And what we need to do is we need to stop focusing on my idea is right, your idea is wrong, that illusion of certainty kicking in, reinforcing that I'm right and that you're wrong. And what we need to do is we need to find that common desired result, because when it comes down to it, we're all really on the same team. We're just trying to find ways to divide us. But if we look to how we're on the same team, we can have much better relationships.
Thank you, Eric Bailey. What a beautiful way to end our conversation on the Peace Brain Show before we go into the Peace Brain Meditation. I truly thank you for that clarity that you just went through. That was excellent. It's been fun talking with you.
It's been a blast. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being on the Peace Brain Show. I look forward to having you at the AZA Mid-Year at the Diversity Summit coming up in April. That's April 14th. At the Arizona Grand Resort in Phoenix. And if any of you are zoo people out there planning on going to the AZA Mid-Year, please sign up for the Diversity Summit. It's free. It's all day on that Sunday, April 14th. And Eric will be the keynote speaker. And you've gotten a taste of your wonderful dialogue, your wonderful ways of thinking and making us think. So thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Very wonderful to have you here. Again, for everyone, Eric Bailey's website is baileyinnovationgroup.com. That's B-A-I-L-E-Y, innovationgroup.com. So please go check it out. And now I invite everyone just to take a breath. We're going to go into a Peace Brain meditation, a short one. And as always, give yourself a grounding cord. Give yourself that energetic connection between the base of your spine and the center of the planet. I like to envision a beam of light or a tree trunk or maybe a monkey's tail coming out of the base of your spine, going into Mother Earth, really anchoring you in the present moment, allowing you to be steady and secure and here. And I love what Eric was talking about, our debates and how we actually have meaningful or can have meaningful conversations. So think about some issue that you are wanting to have solved, and it could be in your corporation, your work, it could be in your relationships with your family or your neighborhood. And think about, as he broke it down into, what's your purpose? Why do you care about this issue? And then the process, the method that you have in your mind that would solve everything, and I'm sure that is one excellent solution. But it may not be what everyone is feeling in this particular issue. So allow yourself to think about, I was going to say doodle and draw, but in your mind, allow yourself to take a breath and be calm and to realize that there are multiple ways to think about the solution of how we humans can solve issues and come to a plan of action. And realize that it perhaps is the next step for you might be to question your neighbor, your colleague, your family member. Now, what is your purpose? Do you care about this issue? And realize you really are working on the same team. You are coming together to solve that issue, and in a new way, though. Explore, be willing to give up your particular way of doing it for a moment, and explore other solutions, other ways. We humans are so innovative, we're so creative, that we have this amazing imagination that can come up with new solutions that are definitely outside of the box. So give yourself permission to do that, to really think outside the box, and to work with your colleague, your neighbor, your family member, to find how you can, for the same purpose, the same caring to solve the solution, come up with solutions, the methodology that would achieve that end. Be willing to learn. Be willing to learn new things, not just have it be the way we've each always done things, and habits are so easy to stay hooked into, to demand that we do things the same way. So take a breath and imagine a beautiful outcome between you and a beautiful friendship blossoming and understanding of, oh, this is the way they think. I get it. I now can have even deeper conversations with them, and we can do new projects together. And that helps create a peaceful world. Congratulations. Good job. So take a breath, and you can open your eyes or bring yourself back to the present moment. Thank you so much for tuning into the Peace Brain Show today. And if you wish to find out more about my guest, Eric Bailey, again, go to baileyinnovationgroup.com. And if you wish to find out more about me, Dr. Gail Lash, and how we might assist your company or business in opting for peace and creating peace parks, where we can have this type of community dialogue about how to bring about a peaceful world, please go to tourismforpeace.com. Or you can email me at hello@peacebrain.org. So now please go forth and activate your peace brain and put your peace park on our World Peace Trails map. Thanks for tuning in. Many blessings.
Thank you for joining us on the Peace Brain Show. You can find us at tourismforpeace.com. Be sure to check out Dr. Gail's Akashic Records readings, her peace plans for your business or organization, and her recently published book, Opt for Peace, 9 Essential Steps to Achieving Peace, Power, and Prosperity. Tune in to BBS Radio Station 1 every other Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 p.m. Eastern to the Peace Brain Show for your next installment of wonder, inspiration, and practical peace.